And on March 14th, don't miss Kingston's Good Times supergroup, Rocket Surgery. On March 16th, the Great Big C's Sean McCann hits the Spire, and the Mahones rage the stage on St. Patrick's Day. On March 20th, the Cancer Bats return to town, and on March 22nd, Canadian pop sensation and Queens alum Devin Cole puts on a show. And on March 29th, don't miss the sweet sounds of Dom Lewis. Unless noted, all KPP shows co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM take place at the Broom Factory. For full info and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com. This CDG month, discover how Queen's alumni are driving meaningful change through impactful careers aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. On Wednesday, March 26, Queen's students are invited to join Queen's Career Services and the Principal's Office for the Work with Impact Alumni Panel discussion. You will hear inspiring stories, gain insights into professional journeys, and learn practical strategies for creating social impact and inspiring hope through your own career. Register to attend through My Career or through Queen's CDG Month Canada calendar.
Democracy Now!
We woke up and got out of our tents to the streets. They fired a missile here near us. We looked around and found fire coming from the strike. While we ran to see what happened, we found a second missile that had been fired. The tents were on fire. The women started to scream, and the children were terrified.
Over 400 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza after Israel launched devastating airstrikes, shattering the nearly two-month-old ceasefire. We'll go to a Gaza hospital and speak to a doctor who says more than 40 dead bodies have been brought in to his hospital alone. Then to Yemen, where at least 53 people were killed after President Trump ordered U.S. airstrikes targeting the Houthis.
With the help of God Almighty, the Yemeni armed forces will continue to impose a naval blockade on the Israeli enemy and ban its ships in the declared zone of operations until aid and basic needs are delivered to the Gaza Strip.
Plus, we look at Donald Trump's takeover of the famed Kennedy Center for the Arts. We'll speak to folk musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman, who performed last week at the center and unfurled banners on stage, quote, reinstate queer programming and creativity at the Kennedy Center must not be suppressed.
By weaponizing the Kennedy Center stages, Trump has systematically sought to silence queer and BIPOC artists under the flimsy pretense of rooting out wokeness. A dog whistle for anything that dares challenge his hateful and dangerous administration.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's unilaterally ended the Gaza ceasefire, launching a massive wave of airstrikes overnight that killed at least 404 people and wounded more than 560 others, numbers that are expected to rise with scores of victims still trapped in the rubble. The attacks began without warning, though earlier today, Israel's military warned residents in several Gaza border regions to evacuate immediately after declaring their neighborhoods to be dangerous combat zones. Survivors of the assaults said entire families were wiped out, with children and the elderly among the dead.
Almost the entire family was martyred, all of them in pieces, and our house collapsed on us. Our house is directly next to theirs. There are also injuries at the Sattari house. They're still pulling people out from under the rubble. We were sleeping just before Suhoor, breakfast, and the house almost fell on us.
The White House said Israel gave the U.S. advance warning about the renewed assault on Gaza. Even before the airstrikes, Palestinians were suffering from more than 2 weeks of an Israeli-imposed blockade on all fuel and humanitarian aid into Gaza. On Sunday, UNICEF reported a third of young children in northern Gaza are suffering from acute malnutrition, adding, quote, 1 million children are living without the very basics they need to survive yet again, they said, after headlines. We'll get the latest from Gaza. Israeli prosecutors agreed to cancel a planned hearing today in Prime Minister Netanyahu's corruption trial due to Israel's renewed assault on Gaza. Netanyahu had been scheduled to testify. On Sunday, he said he would remove Israel's top domestic intelligence official, head of Shin Bet, Ronen Bar. Shin Bet has been investigating two of Netanyahu's advisors over document leaks and ties with Qatar. The news set off protests in Israel, with more planned this week.
It's going to harm the negotiation to release all the hostages. I think Bibi doesn't want to release all the hostages, because when he released all the hostages and he had declared that the end of the war, that's the end of his political situation.
On Friday, the Associated Press reported Israeli and U.S. officials claim to have contacted counterparts in Sudan, Somalia and Somaliland to discuss taking in expelled Palestinians from Gaza. According to the Associated Press, Sudan has rejected the idea, while Somalia and Somaliland say they are not aware of any such contacts. President Trump has repeatedly called for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. The UN's Human Rights Office says Israel has significantly expanded and consolidated illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank in violation of international law. In a statement, UN High Commissioner Volker Turk said, quote, "The transfer by Israel of parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies amounts to a war crime." His comments came amidst a wave of attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinian communities in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem. Last week, settlers attacked the village of Kirbet al-Majam, firing live ammunition and throwing tear gas bombs as they set fire to cars and three Palestinian homes.
Abu Muhammad closed the door, and then they climbed on top of the house and started to throw stones. They broke the door and the windows. Then they burnt this door and entered and set fire inside the house. We went in to take the children out of the house. We didn't find the children. They took the children with them. When they saw us, they left the children.
In Yemen, UNICEF has confirmed at least two children were killed in U.S. strikes after U.S. forces launched a large-scale military operation against the Houthis. The UN agency's findings directly contradict this claim by a Pentagon spokesperson.
The civilian casualty side, no indications of any civilian casualties. We, of course, have seen some of the accusations by the Houthis. We look at those closely when they do come in, but we have no credible indications of any civilian casualties.
The Pentagon called the military operation against the Houthis open-ended and said attacks will continue, quote, until we achieve the president's objectives, unquote. On Monday, tens of thousands of people rallied in Yemen's Houthi-controlled capital, Sana'a, to protest the U.S. strikes, which have reportedly killed dozens of civilians. Meanwhile, the Houthis have claimed another attack on a U.S. naval vessel in retaliation for U.S. strikes on Yemen. The Houthis said last week the group would resume targeting Israeli-linked shipping in the Red Sea due to Israel's ongoing blockade and now war on Gaza. President Trump has threatened the United States will hold Iran responsible for any further retaliatory attacks from the Houthis, saying on social media Tehran would, quote, suffer the consequences, unquote. In a letter to the U.N. Security Council, Iran's ambassador to the U.S. expressed his, quote, deep concern and strong condemnation of Trump's remarks. Lebanon and Syria have agreed to a ceasefire after a cross-border skirmish escalated into 2 days of fighting that Lebanon's health ministry says killed 7 civilians, including a 4-year-old girl. Syria's interim government accused Hezbollah of starting the fighting by abducting and killing 3 Syrian soldiers. Hezbollah denies the claim. Separately, Syria's state news service reports 3 people were killed and 19 wounded Monday night. Launched airstrikes on the southern province of Daraa. The strikes targeted a military site previously used by the Assad regime, but now under the control of Syria's interim government. In Washington, D.C., a federal judge heard arguments from a Justice Department lawyer Monday after the Trump administration defied the judge's order Saturday to turn around two Salvador-bound deportation flights carrying Venezuelan nationals and to ground a third plane that took off after the order was issued. During a contentious exchange, the Justice Department attorney repeatedly refused to answer many of Judge James Boasberg's questions, claiming he was not authorized to do so. The case was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union. Speaking after Monday's hearing, ACLU lawyer Lee Gelernt called the situation a constitutional crisis.
At this point, it seems like the administration is simply walking into court and telling a federal court they can't look at the evidence, they can't stop what they're doing, and we see constant public statements from administration officials criticizing federal judges, saying they don't have authority. I think we're on dangerous ground here in the United States.
To see our interview with Lee Gelernt, go to democracynow.org. Judge Boasberg set a deadline of noon today for the Justice Department to provide more information on deportation flights, including how many people it believes are covered by the Alien Enemies Act of 1789, which the Trump administration invoked to justify the deportations. The Justice Department is now attempting to remove Judge Boasberg from the case altogether. Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, told Fox News the judge does not have authority over the planes because they were over international waters when his written order was issued. Homan added, quote, I don't care what the judges think. Meanwhile, White House aide Stephen Miller appeared on CNN falsely asserting the Trump administration has the right to violate court orders it disagrees with.
What we are expecting is the Supreme Court to say what has always been the case, which is when the president is using his powers as commander in chief, those determinations are not subject to judicial review. How are you going to expel illegal alien invaders from our country who are raping little girls, who are murdering little girls, if each and every deportation has to be adjudicated in a district court judge? And that means you have no country, it means you have no sovereignty, it means you have no future.
The Department of Homeland Security said Monday it had detained and deported Brown University professor Dr. Rasha Alawiya, despite a judge's order that she was not to be removed from the United States. Her lawyers argued the federal government willfully disobeyed the court order. DHS said it deported Alawiya because she attended the funeral of slain Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah during a February trip back home to Lebanon. The funeral was a major event in Beirut, attended by hundreds of thousands of people. The deportation over the weekend triggered major uproar, including in the medical community. Dr. Alawiya is a transplant nephrologist, a highly specialized surgeon in critical need, and associate professor at Brown University. The Environmental Protection Agency is planning to eliminate its Scientific Research and Development Office, firing as many as 1,155 chemists, biologists, toxicologists, and other scientists. That's according to documents reviewed by Democrats on the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin has said he wants to cut 65% of EPA's budget as part of mass layoffs. In Houston, Texas, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Johnson Space Center Monday for a union-led rally to oppose mass firings and layoffs imposed on NASA by Elon Musk and his DOGE operation. Ars Technica reports Trump's considering cuts of up to 50% of NASA's science budget, a prospect described by the Planetary Society as, quote, nothing short of an extinction-level event for space science, unquote. Meanwhile, DOGE staffers flanked by D.C. police officers forced their way into the U.S. Institute of Peace on Monday after a standoff with senior employees. The Institute's CEO, former U.S. ambassador to Senegal, George Moose, who was fired on Friday, condemned the move as an illegal takeover of a nonprofit group.
We have been talking to them for many weeks now, and in anticipation of just this possibility, and also to remind them that we are a private, nonprofit corporation in the District of Columbia, and therefore not a federal agency, and therefore the federal government has no entitlement to come in and take over our building.
The entire board of the U.S. Institute of Peace was also removed, except for Trump's newly appointed members, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and National Defense University President Peter Garvin. President Trump says he's ready to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin today about his proposed 30-day ceasefire deal for Ukraine. Ahead of the conversation, Trump said negotiators are looking at, quote, dividing up certain assets, unquote. That's likely to include pressing Ukraine to accept Moscow's claims over Russian-occupied territory and control of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which Russia has occupied since 2022. Russia's also demanding guarantees that Ukraine will never join NATO. Ukrainian officials have repeatedly said Russia must surrender all of the territory it has seized. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Rwanda-backed M23 armed group announced Monday it'll no longer participate in peace talks scheduled for today in Angola's capital. M23's reversal came as the group objected to European Union sanctions imposed on its leaders, as well as several Rwandan military officers over gross human rights abuses committed during M23's offensive in eastern DRC, which has killed over 7,000 people since January. In Texas, a midwife has been arrested for providing abortions, marking the first time a provider faces criminal charges under the state's near-total abortion ban. Maria Margarita Rojas owned and operated a network of health clinics in the Houston suburbs. One of her employees, Jose Lay, was also charged. Both are also being accused of practicing without a medical license. The abortion charge is a second-degree felony in Texas and punishable by up to 20 years in prison. President Trump Monday toured the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and attended his first board meeting since installing himself as chair. Trump criticized the renowned venue, saying it was in, quote, tremendous disrepair, as is a lot of the rest of our country, most of it because of bad management, Trump said. Last month, Trump led a complete overhaul of the Kennedy Center, replacing all Democratic appointees to the board with his own political allies, donors, and their wives, including Second Lady Usha Vance. A growing number of artists have refused to perform there or use their appearances to protest the Trump administration. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with two musicians who performed last week and held up banners in protest. And the documentary Armed Only with a Camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renaud, which premiered last week at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas, has received the festival's Audience Award in the documentary short competition. Directed by Craig Renaud, the film tells the story of his brother Brent Renaud, the first Western journalist killed by Russian soldiers during the first weeks of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He was killed on March 13, 2022. Brent received a posthumous director's credit for the film as well. It was produced by Downtown Community Television and HBO. To see our interviews with the Renaud brothers, with Craig and Brent over the years, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel's unilaterally ended the two-month-old Gaza ceasefire agreement, launching a massive wave of airstrikes overnight that killed at least 400 people and wounded more than 560 others, numbers that are expected to rise with scores of victims still trapped in the rubble. Palestinian health officials say many of the dead are children. The attacks began without warning, though earlier today, Israel's military warned residents of several parts of Gaza to evacuate immediately after declaring their neighborhoods to be dangerous combat zones. This is a survivor of an Israeli attack on Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis.
We woke up and got out of our tents to the streets. They fired a missile here near us. We looked around and found fire coming from the strike. While we ran to see what happened, we found a second missile that had been fired. The tents were on fire. The women started to scream, and the children were terrified. Of course, everything escalated suddenly. We ran towards the scream. Then we came here and started to pull out the injured people and those who had been martyred.
The White House said Israel gave the U.S. advance warning about its renewed assault on Gaza. Even before the airstrikes, Palestinians were suffering from more than 2 weeks of an Israeli-imposed blockade on all humanitarian and fuel aid to Gaza. On Sunday, UNICEF reported a third of young children in northern Gaza are suffering from acute malnutrition, adding, quote, 1 million children are living without the very basics they need to survive yet again, unquote. Already strained from 15 months of war and a two-week siege, hospitals in Gaza are struggling to keep pace with this new wave of deadly attacks. Just before today's broadcast, we reached Dr. Feroz Sidwa, an American trauma surgeon volunteering at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, Gaza.
This is Feroz Sidwa. I'm a trauma surgeon in California, currently volunteering at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, on the western side of Khan Yunis in Gaza. Overnight, the Israelis resumed bombardment of Gaza. The latest reports are that about 400 people were killed. I know at least 40 arrived dead at our own hospital. Certainly many more went on to die, and many more will die in the future. Overnight, it's hard to remember now, but I think I did 6 operations. I'm about to do a 7th one right now, which is why I can't join you live. I apologize. Half of them were children. Half of the patients I saw in the ER were also children, just like last time when I was at Gaza European Hospital about a year ago. Half the victims were children. Half the operations I did were children. Probably a good third of them will go on to die despite us being able to take care of them properly, just because we really we can do the initial operations, but we don't have the facilities or the ability to take care of them properly after that. And on top of that, they're all coming in malnourished. They're all dehydrated. They've all had gastroenteritis constantly for the past 15 months. The whole human society here is just devastated, and that results in bad health outcomes, as you can imagine, especially when you get your intestines torn open. One of my Palestinian colleagues, his father-in-law, has been killed just a few hours ago. He was actually running the triage in the emergency room, so keeping people outside, making sure that people could access the hospital who actually needed it, and the kind of what we call walking wounded, people who were injured but could wait to be seen were kept in a separate place. His father-in-law was killed, and he found out about that like an hour into the process of the mass casualty event. Just kept working. Didn't go to see him until he'd already been buried this morning, because he had to take care of his patients. One of the women who I operated on, 29-year-old woman, her sacrum, lowest bone on your spine, between your spine and your pelvis, has a probably tennis ball sized hole in it, which is basically the whole sacrum. And her rectum was torn in half. Her bladder is injured. Her vagina is injured. She's a 29-year-old woman. She's actually the sister of one of the doctors who works at the hospital. I didn't find that out afterwards until after I operated on her. It's obviously quite devastating. I suspected that the war would restart while I was here. While I was volunteering on this trip, because the Israelis basically announced that they would restart it while I was here. Nevertheless, it's kind of heartbreaking to see a return to that same bare level of just trying anything to survive that the Palestinians have been forced to do for the past 15, 16 months. They got about a month and a half break from it. A little bit of normalcy with the ability to eat with their families during Ramadan, even if it was in a tent, the ability to drink water that was at least desalinated, if not clean and fit for human consumption. That's all gone again. And it's all because we provide the funding, the diplomatic, the economic, and the military support. And we don't have to. We didn't have to under Biden. We certainly don't have to under Trump. Trump says he wants to end the endless wars. So, okay, do it. It's not that hard. All you have to do is stop providing the arms for them. Americans, I just hope people will do something about this and not let this happen again. Another round of just extreme, senseless mass killing, mostly of children, mostly of refugees, and mostly of people who are literally barred from leaving this concentration camp that they were born into.
That's Dr. Feroz Sidwa, trauma surgeon volunteering at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, Gaza, with Med Global. Last year, he volunteered at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis. To see our interview with him last week when he just arrived at Nasser Hospital, go to democracynow.org. For more, we are going right now to Gaza. We are joined right now by Abu Bakr Abed. He is in Deir al-Balah, which has been hit hard. We'll see if we can keep this connection going. Abu Bakr, thank you so much for being with us. Abu Bakr is a 22-year-old journalist. He used to be a soccer commentator, but now, as he says, he's an accidental war correspondent. Describe the scene in Deir al-Balah, Abu Bakr.
Yeah, there are very chaotic and hectic scenes coming out from every place. Talking about several bombings that have happened since the very, very early morning, and particularly here in this place. And we talk about the casualties and how we were hearing people's screams, people's wails. I could hear my neighbors wailing in pain over the love, over their loved ones and over their children. It was...
We're having trouble keeping that line going, but we absolutely thought it was worth attempting.
Something we've never imagined. And you can tell me this being that the attacks started to happen.
We're going to try to reconnect with him. You can see it's extremely difficult. Israel has shattered the ceasefire, is bombing all through Gaza. But we're going to turn right now to Diana Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Diana, you heard a moment Abu Bakr. Before that, you heard Dr. Feroz. And, of course, you're getting reports since Israel shattered the ceasefire. Can you describe what has taken place, the shattering of these negotiations and what it means?
It's really important, Amy, to keep in mind that what Israel's doing is it's actually just uniformly bombing Palestinians because it can. Over 90% of the buildings in the Gaza Strip have already been bombed. And so what Israel claims that it's doing is that it's targeting structures, and yet there's nothing there any longer. So this is not, it's not at all surprising that we've seen the death toll reach 413 with over 560 Palestinians who are injured. We're expecting that this death toll is going to rise substantially over the next few hours. And it's because Israel used over 100 airplanes to attack all throughout the Gaza Strip. And the reason that they're doing so is because there's been nobody that has stopped Israel. All that we've seen over the course of the past 15 months is a demand that Palestinians somehow negotiate with the Israelis. And there's been absolutely no guarantee that Israel's going to stop the bombing, that it's going to allow humanitarian aid, that it's going to rebuild Gaza, and that it's going to have Palestinians lead a normal life. And so we're seeing this because Israel knows that it can get away with it. And it knows that it can get away with it because it got away with it during the previous administration, and certainly going to get away with it under the Trump administration.
And Diana, what kind of a notice did the residents of Gaza receive before these attacks happened? Israel is claiming that the negotiations reached a dead end, but did they really negotiate at all?
No, they never negotiated at all. That was also another one of the problems. We had the first phase of the negotiations, which Israel both halted and as well was violating. And then it never entered into any earnest negotiations over the second phase. And that second phase was going to lead to Israeli withdrawal and, of course, reconstruction and so on. So much so that the Israelis failed to send their negotiators most of the times. So it was clear that what Israel wanted was that it wanted to continue to resume the attacks on the Gaza Strip, that this pause was simply a pause in order to change the different U.S. administrations. And that's it. And once again, it goes back to this issue of whether it is that Israel can get away with committing these massive war crimes. And it's clear to Israelis and to Israel that it can, unless there is some international action to actually bring Israel to a halt, to stop the weapons flow, to put sanctions on Israel, to hold these criminals to account. I'm afraid we're going to continue to see this. And we knew this when the ceasefire agreement was signed.
Deanna, I want to try once again because it is so rare. As people who watch corporate media know, they almost get nothing out of Gaza directly. We spoke to Dr. Feroz Sidwa. We are continuing to try to get a comprehensible line to Abu Bakr Abed, journalist in Deir al-Balah. Abu Bakr, what is it most important for people to understand? And were you surprised by these airstrikes right now?
People have to understand, Emmy, that the corpses of people are now piled up in the morgues of the hospitals here in Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. We've been seeing children, babies killed and taken to the hospital, and mothers wailing over the bodies of their loved ones. People have not yet recovered from the endless trauma they have been through during the past 15 months. We haven't taken a breath from what we have been enduring. And it just happened all out of a sudden. We were harshly awakened. We couldn't really understand what was happening. I'm talking to you and I'm literally shaking. People have to understand that the people of Gaza cannot really go into any more seconds of this war. This is just indiscriminate, unbearable, insurmountable, inconceivable. I don't know what more words I can tell you to describe the scenes at the moment. People don't know. We have right now overpricing and scarcity of food items. People don't know. People have spent their days, the past 24 hours, without a single meal at all. I know families and been to good family. And for me personally, I just had some bread along with some cheese. The prices are insane. Everything is going right now is absolutely insane. It's just about like you're hearing your neighbors screaming in pain. That kind of screams and that kind of several bombings that has happened over time has just revoked a lot of painful memories that I've been through and that I've had during the past 15 months. And we needed our time to take some rest. We said that the ceasefire would secure some peace for us or some tranquility, some rest from what we have been enduring. But unfortunately, it seems otherwise. Now we're getting back to it. We're talking about more than 400 people have been killed, mostly children. Here in Deir al-Balah, at least 20 people have been killed. We're talking about a family that lives near us that has been wiped out, more than 7 people, and another family almost wiped out with more than 5 members. That is literally unbearable. We cannot really have a genocide rolling back again. We cannot really allow the word, I know why the word, we wanted the word to do us a favor and left the blockade, the current blockade, but the word allowed Israel to continue and resume the genocide. This is literally unbearable. I can't tell you how we're feeling, how the children are feeling. Now, in Deir al-Balah, we've gone away right now. We've visited one of the nearby centers, the desalination plants, and they've told us that they don't have a single drop of potable water. So Deir al-Balah is devoid of a single drop of water, of potable water for the population. So how can we cope? We cannot really brace ourselves for starvation again, for bombardments again. We cannot really blot out our pain because we don't have the means to live.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Deanna Bhutto, the reports from the AP, press reports in recent days that the United States and Israel have reached out to 3 African governments, Sudan, Somalia, and Somaliland, for possibly hosting Palestinians who would be removed from Gaza. Your reaction to that?
It's not at all surprising. This is exactly what Israel has been wanting to do, which is to commit genocide as well as ethnically cleanse Gaza. And the fact that we're seeing these plans go ahead, despite the fact that both of them are illegal under international law, it shows you the state of the world. And so it's not at all surprising that they have been doing this, because from the beginning of the genocide, since October of 2023, Netanyahu made it clear that he wanted the Gaza Strip to be smaller in size and thinner in population. What that means is that he wants to see ethnic cleansing, he wants to see genocide, and he wants to see the takeover of the land of the Gaza Strip. And with President Trump, this is precisely what they're implementing.
And I wanted to ask you, Deanna Bhutto, about Israeli prosecutors agreeing to cancel a planned hearing today in the prime minister in Netanyahu's corruption trial due to his launching this major assault on Gaza. Do you think that's what's motivating it?
Absolutely. Look, a lot of what Israel has been doing lately and what Netanyahu has been doing lately is in order to save his own political career. He's a deeply unpopular prime minister. Israelis are looking at him and blaming him for not only corruption, but for everything that's going on in the country. And in order to save his hide, to prevent himself from going into prison, he's been doing everything to try to prolong this genocide. He's been doing everything so that that Palestinians are the ones who are paying the price with their bodies, literally, in order to prevent Netanyahu from going into prison.
Breaking news. The breaking news, Juan, the Otzma Yehudit Jewish Power Party, led by the far-right lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir, is returning to Netanyahu's coalition government. The hardline party, which opposed a ceasefire with Hamas and pressed for Israel to cut off aid to Gaza, had left the coalition in January. Now, the return strengthens Netanyahu's position. Before a crucial budget vote expected next week, your response to that, Diana?
Yes, this was also not at all surprising, because what Ben-Gvir, this is a man who's racist, fascist, who's called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. What he was saying at the beginning was that he never wanted to see a ceasefire, that he wants to see Palestinians from Gaza, ethnically cleansed from Gaza. He withdrew from the coalition over the idea of a ceasefire agreement. And now that Israel has resumed the genocide, he's come back into the fray in order to make Netanyahu's coalition even stronger, so that he can then not only pass the budget, but continue to be able to put into place these genocidal policies. One thing that's important to keep in mind is that Ben-Gvir is also the person who's been pushing for Israeli settlers to come and take over the Gaza Strip. So what we're now seeing is a combination of the continuation of genocide, as well as pushing forward. We're probably going to see pushing forward plans for Israeli settlers to take over the Gaza Strip, something that they were talking about from the very beginning.
And Abu Bakr Abed, if you could still hear us, I wanted to know even before Israel was resumed bombing, what was the situation in terms of receiving aid or water for the people in Gaza?
For 16 days, consecutive 16 days, there hasn't been a single aid truck allowed into the territory, and has exacerbated the situation. And even during the ceasefire, we're talking about more than 150 that have been killed. Now, Israel, in just 10 hours, has killed over double this number, in fact. And we're now just seeing markets running out of food. Like, I've gone out to see if markets have food items at the moment, but they don't have. And now, what is the situation? We really talk about the hospitals here. They are calling out people to come and donate blood because they don't have blood units. I've talked to a doctor from the hospital in Maseirat, and he told me that the hospital is void of literally every basic necessity. They're dealing with the bare minimum in their hands, the less than the bare minimum in their hands. They're trying to treat patients with almost nothing. That is absolutely barbaric, because Israel hasn't been allowing aid into Gaza, hasn't been allowing medical supplies. They needed medical supplies to treat the influx of injuries that have been left because of the war, because of the genocide. Now, more than 700 have been wounded in the past 10 hours. Well, 400 have been killed. More than 400 have been killed. I don't know when this will end, but we're hearing by Israeli helicopters in Fayyad along the eastern outskirts, quite a few meters away. I haven't slept all night. Until now. So when can we have this kind of relief? When can we stay like calm and have our rights as a human? We're still in the same bubble. Palestinians dream to live. The whole world to dream. We want to go out of that zone and see, have dreams. No dreams. Even there's a dream that we want to live is no longer feasible. That is the peak of the humanization. That is millions, many dreams in Gaza have been destroyed. Many dreams have been crushed. Many families are still under the rubble. We haven't even recovered the bodies from under the rubble because Israel hasn't been allowing the heavy vehicles into Gaza. The bulldozers and the caterpillars, people wanted to build a new life. Israel didn't allow that. Israel wants clearly to erase every sign of hope inside Gaza. But we will continue to hope. We will continue to carry that. And even if it's not our time, the next generations would carry that hope until we make sure that we live the life we want, because we are humans and we deserve to live and we teach life.
Abu Bakr Abed speaking to us from Gaza, from Deir al-Balah, which has been very hard hit. He also reports for Drop Site News. Diana Bhutto, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And this news from Haaretz, the Hostages and Missing Families Forum, said today, following the resumption of Israel's attack in Gaza, that the greatest fear of the families, the hostages and the citizens of Israel has come true. The Israeli government has chosen to give up on the hostages, they said. Coming up, we look at Yemen, where at least 53 people have been killed after President Trump ordered U.S. airstrikes targeting the Houthis. Back in 30 seconds. Immigrant from the Mickey 17 soundtrack scored by Jung Jae-il. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Yemen, where the Trump administration's vowed to continue military strikes against the Houthis, which controls large parts of Yemen. Since Saturday, U.S. warplanes have launched dozens of large-scale military attacks on multiple towns across Yemen. The Trump administration ordered the strikes after the Houthis threatened to resume attacks on Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea in response to Israel's ongoing blockade of the Gaza Strip. On Monday, President Trump said the U.S. will hold Iran responsible for any further attacks by the Houthis and threaten the Iranian government with dire consequences. Trump wrote on Truth Social, "Every shot fired by the Houthis will be looked upon from this point forward as being a shot fired from the weapons and leadership of Iran, and Iran will be held responsible and suffer the consequences, and those consequences will be dire," Trump said. Iran's ambassador to the U.S. expressed his deep concern and strong condemnation of the statements in a letter to the U.N. Security Council. At a press briefing later on Monday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt underscored President Trump's warnings.
Our message to Iran is you better take this president seriously. And I think the Houthis learned that the hard way this past weekend. As I said in my opening remarks, there's a new sheriff in town, and this president is not just going to sit on his hands and allow terrorists to launch attacks on commercial vessels and U.S. naval ships. Those actions will not be tolerated.
The Houthis, meanwhile, are vowing to continue attacks against all, quote, hostile targets in the Red Sea until the attacks on Yemen stop. They also claim to have attacked three U.S. warships in the Red Sea. Yemen's health ministry says at least 53 people have been killed in U.S. strikes, the majority of them women and children. UNICEF has confirmed at least two children were killed in U.S. strikes, contradicting claims by Pentagon officials Monday that no civilians have been harmed in the bombing of Yemen.
The civilian casualty side, no indications of any civilian casualties. We, of course, have seen some of the accusations by the Houthis. We look at those closely when they do come in, but we have no credible indications of any civilian casualties.
For more on Yemen, we're joined now by a guest who spent years reporting in Yemen's civil war and the Houthis, journalist Safa Al-Ahmed. She's the award-winning director of the Frontline documentaries Yemen Under Siege and The Fight for Yemen. Her last piece for Frontline, targeting Yemen, investigated the last major attack by the Trump Trump administration on Yemen back in 2017. Safah joins us from Menlo Park, California. Welcome to Democracy Now! We just have a few minutes, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the significance of these major strikes on Yemen this weekend, Safah, that are ongoing.
Yes. I mean, this is quite significant, but unfortunately, this has been happening in Yemen through across many administrations since George W. Bush. But now the reasoning is different. And unfortunately, Biden had been doing that in Yemen for the same excuse for the freedom of movement of vessels in the Red Sea, but not to this number of casualties. This is quite a shocking number.
And Safah, on social media, President Trump vowed to use overwhelming lethal force like nothing you've seen before against Yemen. What is your sense, and also his attempt to blame Iran and threaten Iran for any further attacks? Your response to those comments of the president?
I think those comments are misleading and indicating that the relationship between Iran and the Houthis or Ansarullah are similar to that of, say, Hezbollah in Lebanon. They are not the same. They don't adhere necessarily to what Iran says. Yes, they do have a very close relationship, but not to the same extent. And so this is disingenuous in saying that everything that the Houthi does is under the direct command of the Iranians, and this is not true.
And initially, the Houthis had paused their attacks against Israeli vessels, but said they would renew them last week after Israel halted entry of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Are there any reports that they actually attacked Israeli vessels?
Not to my knowledge. And they did keep to their word of not attacking any vessels during the ceasefire. But clearly now all bets are off, especially with, unfortunately, what's been happening in the last few hours with over 400 dead in Gaza. So God knows what will be the Houthi response at this point. I don't think that the Americans' attack on Yemen this time was in response to attack, but rather because the Houthis had announced that they will start attacking again if the ceasefire doesn't hold, and if they don't lift the embargo on all the aid that was coming into Gaza, which has stopped a few weeks ago.
On Sunday, the head of Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard insisted Iran's not involved with the Houthi attacks, saying Iran, quote, plays no role in setting the national or operational policies of the Houthis. As we wrap up, Safah, do you believe this?
To a certain degree, yes. But they do have a relationship. So I don't know what kind of pressure the Iranians are on to stop the Houthis from attacking. But that's no guarantee that the Houthis would stop the attacks.
Well, and also, have the solidarity of the Houthis with the Palestinians increased their popularity across the Middle East?
Immensely, immensely. Even people who are against them inside Yemen and those within the Yemeni government in Aden, for example, everyone says that what the Houthis have done, none of the other Arab countries have showed the courage in an impactful way on what's happening in Gaza. They're the only ones who have really impacted financially the commerce in the Red Sea. And so to many, many people, not just in the Arab world, that increased their credibility, even though they're accused of their own human rights violations inside Yemen. But from an outsider perspective, but also inside Yemen itself, supporting the Palestinians in Gaza and Palestine in general has incredibly increased Houthi popularity and lessened the critique on the Houthis themselves and what they're doing domestically.
Safah Al-Ahmed, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Saudi journalist who's been reporting on Yemen since 2010. She's the award-winning director of the frontline documentaries Yemen Under Siege and The Fight for Yemen. Coming up, Donald Trump went over to the Kennedy Center for the Arts. He's taken it over. We'll speak to folk musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman, who performed last week at the center and unfurled protest banners on stage. Stay with us.
While spring is in the streets again, and too many seasons gone by, we move to cruise and stare at ourselves, hoping to find someone half blind, somebody who will make us new.
Musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman singing The Unicorn at the Kennedy Center last week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Trump visited the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts on Monday to preside over a meeting of the famed art institution's new board. In his first weeks in office, Trump fired the president of the Kennedy Center, replaced the bipartisan board of trustees, and named himself as chair of the Kennedy Center. New members of the board include his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, and her mother, Second Lady Usha Vance, and two hosts on Fox News, Laura Ingraham and Maria Bartiromo. Last week, Vice President J.D. Vance and Usha Vance were met with a chorus of disapproval as they attended a concert Thursday night at the Kennedy Center. The audience loudly booed as they took their seats for a performance of the National Symphony Orchestra. Trump's move to take over the Kennedy Center has been met with widespread condemnation from the artistic world. Earlier this month, the producers of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway hit Hamilton pulled out of plans to bring the production to the Kennedy Center next year. In a statement, producer Jeffrey Seller said, quote, "Our show simply cannot in good conscience participate and be a part of this new culture that's being imposed on the Kennedy Center." On Monday, Trump criticized Hamilton.
Come here and see a show. I was never a big fan of, I never liked Hamilton very much, and I never liked it. But we are going to have some really good shows. I would say this, come here and watch it, and you'll see over a period of time it'll improve very greatly physically, and we're going to get some very good shows. The thing that does well are Broadway hits, and we have some beauty. I guess we have Les Mis coming, and we have some others, but the Broadway hits have done very well. So I'm going to spend some time. We have a good board. In the meantime, we're running the country, and we're running it well.
Rhiannon Giddens has also canceled an upcoming appearance, as did the actor Issa Rae, who had sold out, and others. We're joined now by two musicians who decided to go ahead with their Kennedy Center concert on Thursday, but opted to use the stage to protest Trump's policies. The folk musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman unfurled banners during their concert that read, "Reinstate queer programming and creativity at the Kennedy Center must not be suppressed." Nora also read this message from the stage.
"We are outraged by the tyrannical change of leadership at the Kennedy Center. By weaponizing the Kennedy Center stages, Trump has systematically sought to silence queer and BIPOC artists under the flimsy pretense of rooting out wokeness, a dog whistle for anything that dares challenge his hateful and dangerous administration. Protest comes in many forms, and we want to honor the legacy of the Kennedy Center as a radical space."
Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman join us in our studio here in New York. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It was Thursday night when Vance was booed that you were there. Nora, start off by talking about the banners you unfurled and your message, why you decided to perform but also share this message of protest.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I guess, there was a lot of lead up to this decision, you know. There are many people canceling, as you mentioned before, and we're really considering what the most effective means of protest would be for us as smaller artists who have access to this stage. And we ended up deciding that our voices would be loudest on the stage, and that that was the place for us to kind of raise some awareness of the situation, but also, like, create a space for collective singing and, you know, use folk music, which is what we do best, to kind of allow for that that resistance to exist in the music itself. Yeah.
Stephanie, what's at stake in your viewpoint for the arts and creative freedom under this Trump administration?
Oh, man, what's at stake for the arts under this Trump administration? I mean, the arts are in a fundamental way for people to express ourselves and for us to recognize other people's stories and experiences and struggles. And for the arts to come under attack by the Trump administration is just seems like such a blatant and disgusting way of trying to divide people. And, you know, as musicians, this is our way of connecting with others. And it just feels like, yeah. That's just such a clear, like, step in the authoritarian playbook.
Yeah, and I feel like art is a unique medium of resistance because it's all about self-expression, and self-expression invites critical thinking. And that's what really is what Trump is afraid of, and we see that in how he's, you know, defunding higher education, that he doesn't want people to question his administration. He doesn't want people to be exposed to other ways of thinking, that, you know, that's really what he's afraid of.
One of the things he did yesterday, there aren't other presidential portraits but John F. Kennedy. It's the John F. Kennedy Performing Arts Center. But he unveiled portraits of himself, of Melania, of J.D. Vance, and of his wife, Usha. You chose one of your songs that you performed was The Unicorn. Why?
Well, I learned this song recently. It's by a guy named Peter Grudzian, who is what maybe would fall into the outsider artist category, kind of an anti-folk thing that was happening in maybe the early 70s. And he was from Astoria and he's been dubbed kind of the first gay male country musician. And so it kind of seemed to fit with the program that we were working on, you know? Yeah, it's a beautiful song, and he's really such an incredible and unique songwriter, and we're excited to share that with people.
Yeah. You express yourselves through your music, and you've brought your fiddle, you've brought your guitar. What do you want to share with us?
Yeah, well, we'd love to play a piece of The Unicorn. It's, you know, the song we love so much, and so we'd love to play it for you now.
Go right ahead.
Yeah.
We welcome Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman on the stage here at Democracy Now!
While in our veins.
The folk musicians Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman, they performed on Thursday. That was the day the Vances were booed as they came into the Kennedy Center. Nora and Stephanie performed The Unicorn and much more. They also unfurled banners at their concert, reading Reinstate Queer Programming and Creativity at the Kennedy Center Must Not Be Suppressed. We're going to ask you to stay after the show and record some more of your music. I thank you so much for being with us. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Angela.